Welcome to Our Interesting Times with host Timothy Kelly, who interviews today's top alternative and revisionist thinkers.
May you live in interesting times.
Welcome to Our Interesting Times. My guest tonight is Jay Dyer. He returns to the show to discuss, Lecture 7 of his Tragedy and Hope series. Jay, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing great, Tim. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Of course, you are the proprietor of Jay's Analysis, and you also have a book coming out very soon, if I understand.
Actually, yeah, it may ship in the next week.
Oh, okay.
I'm supposed to get my author copies this week, and I presume that that means that people that have ordered it will get it too, but I'm not 100% positive.
Okay, of course, that's Esoteric Hollywood, Sex, Cults, and Symbols in Film?
Correct.
Is that the subtitle correct? Okay, there you go. Great, okay, look forward to that. And, well, tonight, of course, maybe if time permitting, maybe get into some of this election, this last-minute election scandal, which I listened to... what's his name? my God, I'm being drew a blank.
Timothy Geithner.
No.
Fox Mulder.
Dr. Joseph Farrell.
Oh, I haven't heard his take yet.
And he was on an interview with a dark journalist. And his take on the Trump candidacy was rather interesting, saying that it's part of – it's a, his whole candidacy is a is being pushed by one faction of the elite to, well, at first to ensure Hillary's election, and now to prevent her election. There's been some changing. I mean, it's, of course, it's speculation, but that somehow people within the elite have gotten Trump to run, and now they this sort of this deep state revolution against Hillary is now a reflection of that sort of backstage intrigue. So I thought that was interesting.
Well, I saw one of the Podesta emails includes a dinner plan with Marina Abramovich, who is the witch that inspires Lady Gaga. And the dinner is supposed to include spirit cooking. There's a video where Marina Abramovich explains what spirit cooking is, and she utilizes pig blood, human semen, and breast milk.
Really?
So that would suggest even occult involvement on top of the pedophilia elements that have been coming out in the past couple of days.
And, of course, that would conflict with Podesta's claims of being a faithful Catholic.
It would seem to. But I was surprised to see that. Somebody told me about that. I thought, on the one hand, I should have been like, yeah, obviously. But then I was also like, no, surely not. But, yeah, there is a dinner with Podesta and Marina Abramovich, and they talk about spirit cooking. And if you don't believe me, watch Marina's video explaining what spirit cooking is.
Wow. Okay.
I mean, it's straight up basic. It's just straight up witchcraft and kind of voodoo type stuff.
Yeah. Well, he is a member of the Trilateral Commission. And, when you get into these elite circles, of course, with your research and, what I've come to learn, that's, again, it's not too shocking once you're aware of that dimension too.
Yeah,
to politics, so it's like Bohemian Grove,
exactly.
So
And this whole thing, the whole Epstein thing, it all seems to be a giant sort of blackmail thing that is really no different than what we've seen with Franklin cover-up and the whole stories of Johnny Gosch and the manor in England where MI5 was surveilling and blackmailing, and they had, you know, Ted Heath and all these people that were coming to this call boy house in England with Saville. Saville, of course, being connected to, as I understand, Epstein and all these characters.
And it's almost like we get a glimpse, and then the investigation is shut down. And the reason why we can only get a glimpse is because a full reckoning or a full investigation would open up a whole can of worms and maybe reveal too much about the true nature of the system, you know. So, but for right now, you just concluded Tragedy and Hope Lecture 7. Of course, last time we talked, we covered Lectures 4, 5, and 6, and we covered the rise of the European banking houses and the eventual primacy of the Rothschild banking house, the intrigues of the Atlantis' powers in the interwar period, and how their dual policy of appeasing and then demonizing Hitler was sort of a dialectic created to foment yet another war in Europe, World War II, I guess you could. And this was a part of a process of doing away with sort of this three-block stage and sort of creating a two-block or bipolar war. This was the Cold War. And this is what you focus on in Lecture 7 when you deal with the rise of the military-industrial complex, the Cold War, the espionage apparatus, and the PSYOP that is nuclear terror, as well as the identity, as you call the identity of the real Illuminati. So, how do you want to get into this?
Of course, it starts in the background of the chapter that Quigley titled The New Age, and rationalization in science and scientism, relativism in the physical sense, which of course is connected to relativism in the philosophic sense as well. Darwinism, Marx, and Freud are all listed by Quigley in that chapter as founding fathers of the modern world. And this is interesting because we know Quigley's onto something, because it echoes writings that we've seen, that I've delved into, and other geopolitical analysts that might not be as well known, like Oswald Spengler or his student, Francis Parker Yockey. Yockey's book Imperium has a whole chapter on, well, actually separate chapters on Darwin, Marx, and Freud as kind of the fathers of modernity. And I think those shifts once again come to the fore as setting the stage for the rise of what Quigley's talking about here with the military-industrial complex, the deep state, the private defense contractors, the research and development labs that are all set up, Lincoln Labs, MIT, RAND Corporation, which is a started Curtis LeMay Air Force. We know as well that also under the aegis of the Air Force is NASA. So NASA is actually going to play into this too, because we're going to see, and this is going to be part of the next lecture that I do, the tie-in between the space race, the missile race, and the shifting of American philosophy, basically, as a kind of outworking of the scientistic deep state. And as Quigley says, pretty clearly, it's all based on pragmatism. It's all based on empiricism, all those philosophical ideas that you and I have already kind of highlighted in the background. And it was a deep state even then that had a dual policy, to use the words of both Chamberlain and now Hillary Clinton in her emails, mentioning a dual policy of a private policy towards the bankers and Goldman Sachs that she gave her talks to, and a different policy for the public idiots out there. And it's no different with our technocratic rulers that were all prepped by World War II. And what we have is this sudden new threat. Okay. It's almost like the threat has to be upped. The ante has to be upped every time. Right. So the warfare, World War I, the dangers and the terrors that we all went through. Well, not we, I guess our grandparents or whatever, great grandparents. That has to be settled. We have to take precautions through a second world war to avoid the dangers of World War I, right? And then after World War II, we have to take new precautions to avoid the dangers of everything that we saw in World War II, which was, you know, the threat of the entire planet being engulfed in war because of nukes. And so, again, nukes, space race, weapons race, it's all connected. And Quigley is going to say that in the next lecture that I do, of course. But for now, I thought that one of the most important chapters in the book, besides perhaps the chapter that I covered this time dealing with the Cliveden set and the Anglo-American establishment that he kind of lays out, Morgan Chase, the different bankers, Walter Lippmann, these characters that Wall Street characters that were part of this Eastern establishment, the New York establishment tied to London, is this chapter on the New Age, because it's very prophetic. It talks about AI. It talks about transhumanism. It talks about cybernetics. It talks about, as we said, RAND corporations, basically the merchants of death, right? And the rise of game theory. We talked about all that last time, but that is, you have to understand that to be the background to Manhattan Project and Dr. Edward Teller, who's also, of course, the father of geoengineering or aerosol spraying, atmospheric aerosol spraying programs. He's known for that. But curiously, there's these little slip in comments by Quigley that the Alexander Sachs and Bernard Baruch is who's behind setting up this UN plan for a Security Council. So the whole point, the whole origin of the UN Security Council comes out of this and the need and desire to watchdog all of the global nuke networks, the nukes that are out there everywhere. Oh, the Russians have nukes now too by the 40s, right? So it's fear, 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 fear. And a lot of other curious statements about the project itself, highly compartmentalized. Only about a dozen persons, Quigley says on page 856, actually knew what the program was as a whole. So it's, in my opinion, it's very difficult, you know, looking back on history to know exactly what was going on here. You know, to what degree are the nukes really a threat? Are there really all these black network, are there these black market nukes out there? I mean, I would say I'm skeptical, but just because I don't know how to prove that. I mean, obviously you can't just go on these, you know, 30, 40, 50 year old images of what appear to be explosions. Those could be anything. Just like I don't think that the original moon images are legitimate. And I think that if you read Dave McGowan's book, Wagging the Moon Doggy, it's pretty laughable to try to prop those images up as legitimate. That also, however, isn't really a statement on what the real technology is. I don't know. And I think that that's kind of the point, is that they would use a lot of this imagery and fear, right? The same stuff with NASA, just like with the bombs and the nukes, as a means to, I mean, it's all perception management. So if you can get everybody thinking it's real, then who cares? You don't even really need it. Quigley also mentions curious statements, as I said before, about some of the atomic spying stories being faked, the FBI and Hollywood working together on that. I've mentioned before, I've got a section in my book, too, on the FBI story with Jimmy Stewart, right, playing this role, the movie that was made in tandem with J. Edgar Hoover. Now, Quigley doesn't say that all the espionage was fake. He says that a lot of it was hyped up. And he also mentions the right wing in America. And he, of course, makes fun of them. And he says that these neo-isolationists are all backwards idiots and goofballs. And the main reason he thinks that is because they haven't seen that their people behind this are not ultimately the commies. It's not ultimately Russians. It's the Atlanticists. It's the elite in this country who wanted this. And so Quigley basically says that, right? Now, he doesn't say that there's no actual opposition in Russia. He supports the argument that Stalin refused the Marshall Plan aid and that this is the beginning of the Cold War. That is, in fact, is where he dates the beginning of the Cold War. But I think what is most telling is also statements about Hollywood nuke propaganda on page 875. So, and I've watched a bunch of bad movies from that period, And there's, you know, you see it everywhere. You know, everybody's got these bomb shelters and everybody's afraid of nukes. And, you know, you stop, drop, and roll, get on your desk or something, like that's going to stop a nuke incinerating you. But I'm not saying that I think ICBMs are real. Obviously, I think they really are intercontinental ballistic missiles. But as to whether they are tipped with a mega weapon that can cut the planet in half, I'm suspicious. But there's a lot of different angles to go on this. But I think what's most interesting is, you know, he does talk about John Birch Society on page 882 or something akin to it. I can't remember if he actually, he basically talks about McCarthyism. And he's talking about the anti-communist movements and how Dulles, who was kind of spearheading a lot of that, was at the same time, you know, a deep state player, right? John Foster Dulles. And then of course, later on his brother, Alan. And so the Dulles brothers, as we know from other books as well, you know, they're not real, quote, anti-communists. They're part of this setting the stage for the Cold War and provoking and continuing the Cold War. And, you know, if they really wanted to not be a Cold War, they wanted to put an end to this, then they wouldn't have done what they did at Yalta and Potsdam. You know, they wouldn't have handed over a third of the world to the communist bloc. And that was all painted as if, oh, there's all these Reds in the U.S. government. Well, there probably were a lot of people who could imbibe this liberalism. And Quigley talks about that at the Institute for Pacific Relations and so forth. But when we stop for a moment and recall that Mao was apparently a Yali, a Yale in China, and that the OSS is who trained his guerrillas and Donovan set up the spy networks throughout China, we start to realize that that's yet another angle of the Cold War that was fake and staged and manufactured. And as you pointed out, David Rockefeller could fly into Moscow. In Rockefeller's own memoirs, he traces the establishment of Chase Bank. That was the first bank in communist China. Everybody also is probably aware, in this audience at least, of the 1973 editorial from a China traveler where David Rockefeller praises Mao as the great social experiment. So there's no real, at that level, opposition. There is the need for this appearance of the godless East and, you know, the godly West, which is again propaganda. So that's what comes to my mind off the bat. But I noticed another point I'll make too, a contradiction. If we look back at the bomb question, Quigley on the one hand says that Oppenheimer was not a great scientist of the class of Einstein, Bohr, and Fermi on page 885, but he calls him a cultural critic and specifically adept at literature and music. Now, about 200 pages later, he says the exact opposite and says that Oppenheimer was the genius behind the Manhattan Project and a great scientist. So what I've noticed going through this and making so many notes is that Quigley's not consistent with himself. He'll say all kinds of things that don't really line up. And that's probably because the book has to have been written over, you know, a long period of time. Nobody could, you know, slap this book out in a few, few months, right?
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't know if you were still there. Yeah. There's a lot of contradictions in Quigley. There's a lot of statements that don't make sense, even about the nukes, which is what, you know, where we're at now. And so I almost think it's very revelatory, but because it's an apologetic book and because it's, you know, intended for a certain academic, professional, government class of audience, even this book is a limited revelation because, for example, the chapters I was just recently reviewing about Castro and Cuba and Bay of Pigs, you don't get anything like the analysis that you get from Servando Gonzalez on that topic, who I think is very insightful. You get a lot of, oh, the CIA just bungled this. They just totally messed up. And granted, maybe that was because, you know, Quigley's writing this right around the time of Bay of Pigs. So, you know, it's a complex book. And I think maybe Quigley was even aware of his own contradictions. Who knows?
or how far he could go.
Well, there you go. That's a better way to put it.
Because there's I had an interview last year with Kevin Cole mm-hmm. about the article in the Washington Post by, I think, Rudy Maxa was the reporter. And the title of the article was "The Professor That Knew Too Much." Mm. And Kevin Cole's analysis of it was "The Article That Said Too Little." And he didn't know what questions to ask. What Quigley was saying in that interview, you didn't have to read through the lines. He obviously suggested if he were to reveal too much, he'd be threatened, whether it's career or his life or something. And mm-hmm. he asked the reporter to turn the tape off. Then he talks about his frustration mm-hmm. with the publisher of his books regarding the plates. And you've talked about that before. The whole thing about was the book suppressed? And well, the owner of the publisher and book was, of course, the owner of the publishing house. You can trace it back to Chatham House and this whole mm-hmm. the road circle. Mm-hmm. He was probably aware of how far he could go, and also probably his own bias, I guess, and what he's mm-hmm. writing about. You mentioned the Manhattan Project, and you bring up Oppenheimer, the fact that he wasn't really a technical person. He was, which you think this would be highly technical. As the administrator of the Manhattan Project.
Yeah, he says several times that the people actually running the project were not scientists.
They were bankers and administrative
people.
Yeah.
Bureaucrats. And then you have these compartmentalized scientists who Quigley says don't really know what was the whole project was.
And Quigley talks, either was it Quigley who wrote some of the scientists are very skeptical about the success of the project?
He says that. They all doubted it. Just like the moon. He mentions the moon, by the way. He says that scientists are doubtful, of the possibility of going to the moon.
Yeah. So the visionaries and the PR guys were saying, oh, we can do this. Like Kennedy's saying, we'll go to the moon by the end of the decade and we'll do it because it's hard or whatever. All the political rhetoric. But the technical people were saying, well, wait a second. This is easier said than done. Uh-huh. That's interesting because like the Manhattan Project, it's like NASA. I was looking at NASA's first administrator, this guy Thomas Glennon. Mm-hmm. And he came from motion picture industry.
There you go. Yeah. This is what we start seeing pretty consistently is this a very strange revolving door that is not the field that you would expect, such as science or physics or engineering.
Yeah, he moved from like motion picture, I think Paramount, to Samuel Goldwyn Studios, mm-hmm. then to like aviation. And mm-hmm. who knows at that level what you're involved in, because I think – at that point with aviation, you're getting into the deep state, the military industrial complex, and maybe you would be involved in some sort of psyop or fakery, right?
No. Absolutely. John Adams over at Hoaxbusters actually dug up a great article on the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Southern California and its connection to Hollywood, believe it or not.
And many other things.
Sure, but this backs up that Hollywood connection that you're talking about. I believe it's by Peter J. Westwick, and this is it's a chapter in some academic book, but it's about the societal impact of JPL, and I believe that's the one where he reconnects it to. Yeah, so there's a lot of mentions of different films that would reflect JPL and how the films would later. And things like IMAX would later be connected directly to NASA and promoting NASA and all this stuff. And CBS's role with NASA, a very close connection there. So if you can find that paper that John Adams dug up, great research on this part. It's called The Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Southern California by Peter J. Westwick. And I would imagine it can be found online. But you're absolutely right. And that's why even now we see – I can't remember who I mentioned this to, but I think I added it to my book right before I had to finish the sidebars. Well, James Cameron is on the board of NASA's Mars project. Not just as some camera guy, but as an advisor. Now, James Cameron is not an astronaut. Well, we all know what James Cameron does. He makes movies. So
yes,
I think that's pretty telling.
He sinks Titanics and he creates CGI stuff and all that. So
he's also a big promoter of aliens.
Yeah. Which again, you're getting into some sort of there's a crossover, blending of you know, of these supposed governmental or national security bureaucracies and well, you could say either entertainment or propaganda or some sort of you know, psychological operation going on there.
Mm-hmm.
And if you talk about the tie-in or the links here, I think was it back in the early 2000s when NASA admitted or claimed that it lost all the original footage of the moon landing, mm-hmm. the high quality footage, mm-hmm. yep. and was it because of Ron Howard was trying to do a high def anniversary of the moonshot or something, and that's when they said they don't have it anymore. He tried to get a hold of the high quality footage. I don't know if I have that right or not.
Well, I think there was some connection to that movie he did, the Apollo movie.
Apollo 13, yeah.
And that movie is based on the movie that NASA told everybody. Because that movie is terrible, by the way. It's really boring, but it's supposed to be this, you know, everybody on the edge of their seats waiting to see if these astronauts can get back. And you stop and think about it, and you realize, oh, this is like completely, you know, a movie script.
Even the movie is about how everyone's kind of by the spring of 1970, people are bored with the Apollo program.
Yeah, that's a great point that David Gallen makes in his book, is that it had to keep kind of upping the ante and making this stuff a little more sensational because people were kind of like, eh.
And by 72, they're playing golf on the moon.
Right, which I pointed out, I think, is the most laughable, preposterous. I thought we were supposed to be worried about danger and life and death, but no, we're such badasses that we play golf on the moon.
Yeah.
So,
and a doom buggy, by the way. So
yeah, how'd they get there? Right. Page 894 and 895 outline the very thing we're talking about. Quigley says the Atomic Energy Commission functioned was a disappointment to the scientists because they sought freedom from military influence, reduced emphasis of military uses of nuclear fission, free dissemination of theoretical research. They failed on all these points. The AEC operated largely in terms of weapons research and production and remained extravagantly secret even on all these theoretical matters. And because of the scientific ignorance of most of the people running it, the commissioners, it was inevitably dominated by its scientific advisory committee of, this is Quigley's own, quote, official scientists. So he's saying what I was saying earlier. Then that's page 894. And then he talks about Bernard Baruch setting up the plan for the UN Security Council. Now, we know as well, I think the Collins brothers have written on this too, the AQCon network.
Yeah, the Cult of the Superweapon article.
Yeah. And this is connected to the CIA, and I did some research of my own a few years ago on that, and you start to realize, oh, this is all kind of run by Western intelligence. What exactly it is, I'm not 100% positive, but it starts to look like the same means and methods by which black market arms and drugs are run. So I'm just throwing ideas out here.
Well, they're managed to create a dialectic to to get money, I guess, to get to to be able to collect proceeds from briberies, all types of illegal arms dealing. There's tons of money involved in that,
right?
You know, and we got a glimpse into that from Iran-Contra, and the private networks, right, that come from that, like Ted Shackley, Kleins, and Ed Wilson in the late 70s, early 80s.
Got a glimpse as well in the last couple of years with the big banks being outed as laundering Mexican cartel drug money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And just recently, HSBC, I think, paid a $1.9 billion fine. Mm-hmm. Of course, they probably made $100 billion doing it. But
I was going to say, yeah, and then who'd they pay it to?
That's another thing is you hear reports of these fines, and no one ever really does a follow. Was that thing ever paid?
Yeah, and if it was, where did it, who did it go to exactly?
I know. But one thing is
go ahead.
Oh, sorry, you were about to make a point?
Sorry, I was about to sneeze. You might have to edit this. I have a sneeze on Andrew. I guess I'm not going to.
There you go.
What were we talking about? Nukes. Networks. Let's see here. Well, so he jumps from the Atomic Energy Commission and all that straight into the
the
subject of Cold War and nuclear rivalry, and then Stalin.
Yeah.
And this is kind of these Cold War war games that are played out, and the Marshall Plan is rejected. This is where he says that 1947 is the beginning of the Cold War, and Germany is, of course, split in half, East and West Germany. I want to point out, too, that the East German flag is a Masonic compass, for those that don't know.
just a coincidence.
Just a coincidence, right. Yeah, just supposed to represent engineering, I'm sure.
You know how the Germans are, you know, with engineering.
So. Also not present in Quigley is the aide to Mao. So, and that might be because, even though you could probably find that in books prior to this time, that wasn't declassified by the CIA until, you know, 13, 14 years ago.
Yet it was suspected because there are people who claim that people like Marshall had sold China out and lost China to the communists. And there was obviously evidence of a communist conspiracy inside the U.S. government, which goes back to McCarthyism and how people had identified, a group working against the perceived interests of the United States, and they immediately thought they were communists. But really, as you point out, they weren't communists. They were, but that's only one level. A higher level, these people were being controlled by, you know, Mao was a communist, right? But Mao was a communist supported by the West.
And that's why Quigley makes fun of the Birchers and the right-wingers and the nationalists. Mm-hmm. He says, more or less, you're all backwards and redneck and stupid, and you couldn't figure out who's behind the Institute for Pacific Relations and who's behind the Rockefeller Foundation and all this stuff, right? So then we get this expansion on the part of the U.S. of the Truman Doctrine, which is the idea of containment, and this is aid to the nations to control them, which we still live under now, obviously, right? Israel, Colombia, Egypt, these are the top beneficiaries of U.S. aid that we know of. And this goes back to the Marshall Plan, and again, that's what those who believe that the degree of reality to the Cold War on the part of Stalin dates from the period, as I said, of the rejection of the Marshall Plan aid. But this is precisely 1947 is crucial because this is where we get the rise of the security state and the intelligence apparatus, the NSA, National Security Act, and then the creation of the CIA, and then the creation of the NSA, National Security Agency. So this is where we get Cold War spy culture, right, from this whole apparatus. And I want to add that the fiction was a big part of that. In fact, John Adams also dug up a very interesting essay. I can't remember the title of it, but he found it at CIA.gov, and it was on the relationship between spy fiction and real spy stuff. And the article was basically saying that a lot of the stories that you hear about spies are fictional, and that the fiction plays into giving everybody the perception of there being moles everywhere and all this. Now, that doesn't mean there are no moles, and it doesn't mean that there aren't real situations where people do, you know, actually engage in espionage.
It creates the meme, yeah.
Right.
And this is why, people like the James Bond novels, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And, also, what's his name? Howard Hunt.
Right? Absolutely, yeah.
He became a novelist. And there's also William F. Buckley, Skull and Bones, CIA William F. Buckley, with Blackford Oaks, his character.
William Somerset Maugham, you know, he wrote spy novels based on his stuff. But
all the best spy novelists are like actual spies.
Exactly.
Yeah, and you made the point regarding, you know, what's his name, the Bond guy.
You know, the who?
You know, the guy who wrote the Bond novels.
Fleming.
Ian Fleming, I mean, his pedigree.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's total psyops, friends with all the banking elite, yeah.
And the predictive programming or revelations in the Bond novels regarding the true nature of the international elite and, you know, how we can.
Absolutely.
So go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that the controversial, I don't know what you would know a lot about this field, the question of the American Communist Party and it basically dwindling. From Quigley says 75,000 in 1945 and fell down to 3,000 by 1960. So we're still being told in 1960, 59, 60, the threat of all the commies. But according to Quigley, By 1960, there were only 3,000 members of the Communist Party. But I guess the argument would be, well, they're all hidden secret commies now.
Yeah, moles and, you know, fifth columnists. And, you know,
but the way they achieved all this was not a secret party. It was the gradual alteration of the culture, I think.
Oh, yeah. I mean, obviously, the cultural Marxist agenda was far more successful than the than the Marxist-Leninist, you know, political model. And even that, I think, is that's being controlled at a higher level. I mean, I don't know if the cultural Marxists, the people at the Frankfurt School who are largely Jewish, are aware that maybe they're being utilized, you know, by, you know, by the Atlanticists, but the powers. But that's a part of it. That's like, even they get, it goes back to the Russian Revolution, where it appears that the Atlanticist scheme against Russia, you know, with the Bekinder doctrine. How they utilize a lot of Jews because they have a gripe against Russia, and so this ethnic group can be very useful, you know, to them. It's particularly if they're people like Untermeyer and Jacob Schiff and the Wahlbergs, things like that. You know, whose brother Max was, of course, was a German financier.
Max Warburg.
So, and of course, there's an interesting quote by his son in the Senate in the 1950, where he's testifying for the Senate, and he says, I think, here it is, February 17, 1950, James Paul Warburg confidently declared to the United States Senate, "We shall have world government whether or not we like it. The only question is whether world government will be achieved by conquest or consent." That's because he was a son of Paul Moritz Warburg and the nephew of both Felix Warburg and Jacob Schiff, both associated with Kuhn Loeb & Company, Wall Street. And this was sort of like the Jewish faction, you know, which played a big part in America's entry into the war because that factors into the Zionist project and the Balfour Declaration, you know. So, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, so. And the also to tie it back into Hollywood, the anti-communists, the Red Threat, the rise of the Hollywood 10 and the investigations into Hollywood and the idea that the screenwriters were all going to write propaganda into the films that would alter the entire perspective of America. Now, some of them were, but the idea that this was the real threat, I think, is, again, exaggerated. Now, I wonder if some of these people weren't playing along with it. I don't have any proof of that, but I read a couple books, actually, that dealt just with the subject of the Hollywood 10. And now I'm not saying all these, you know, Hollywood liberal types, obviously they probably did believe in it, but is it really the threat that the FBI was saying it was? And they, again, they don't mind everybody thinking that the threat is these moles everywhere and all these people in Hollywood, as long as you don't ever look at Wall Street and the Institute for Pacific Relations or the Rockefeller Foundation or the Ford Foundation, or the groups that actually were promoting, even back then, beginning to really promote what people call communism or socialism or whatever.
Yeah, and they're not investigating, perhaps, why is Time Life working with the CIA to promote drug culture, you know?
Yes. You know, why is abstract art being promoted by these elites?
Yeah. Why is Abby Rockefeller promoting feminism and modern art? You know, is this the real degradation? Yeah, or, you know, the LSD experiments and things like that. We don't get we don't get those hearings until the '70s, and they'll that's pretty much a limited hangout. But there's so there's no real showdown like there is with the Hollywood 10, which is sort of a cartoonish, very, very theatrical. Let's just say, which is not surprising. It's the Hollywood 10. It's very theatrical, right? And it's very played up because then these people become martyrs because, you know, Woody Allen makes movies about them and they become heroes, you know, martyrs for free speech. And, you know, the same faction that was so vehemently defended free speech in the '50s and sixties and now are big advocates of political correctness. You know, they're the ones, they're the linguistic fascists who want to control the language, you know?
Yeah. The total flip contradiction.
Yeah.
Hypocrisy there.
Consistency there. One I do notice, you mentioned the military-industrial complex, and you mentioned that he begins writing about it on 9/11, page 9/11. Any numerological significance there? I had to laugh when I hear that. Military-industrial complex on page 9/11.
Well, probably an unintended reference there, but
yeah, who knows?
That is the rise of the security state.
Yes. And
so obviously the elements of the security state in terms of at least the private side of it would play a big role in 9/11, I would say.
Mm-hmm. And you also mentioned, I think you referred to, I'm quoting right, in your lecture, you referred to Cold War as sort of a satire.
The whole thing?
No, just or? I forget what reference, but I thought it was interesting because the Cold War itself is a strategy of tension. It's designed to raise fears, anxiety, in order to justify these huge expenditures, the national security state, the cryptocracy, the National Security Act, the deep state. And what's one thing that's funny about that is, of course, we have in the book, The Report from Iron Mountain, mm-hmm. which has been written off as a satire.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I was well, thinking, that's interesting. Because what we know about satire is that it's a way of telling the truth without getting killed, right?
Well, Dr. Strangelove is
yeah.
a perfect example of that because it tells the truth in a way about the Rand Corporation and Curtis LeMay and these different stories and these tales. And the fake atomic spies is mentioned on 920, right around in that same section.
So, you're referring to like some of these espionage cases as sort of a satire? If I'm remembering that correct?
I may have said that. I don't recall exactly.
Well, I thought it was a useful description because, well, let's first talk about The Report from Iron Mountain. It was published in 1967 by Dial Press, and the book claimed that a special study group of 15 men whose identities were secret met, and they came to the conclusion that war was necessary in order to maintain power, to maintain social cohesion. And some said, well, this is just a joke. Says, yeah, but it may be a joke, but it's reality. Because if you look at NSC 68 and the thinking behind with those people among the national security, the upper echelons of the national security state, this is exactly what they think.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
But I think I was likening it to, if I recall, Dr. Strangelove.
And okay.
There's a quote on page 923, the Red Conspiracy section, where Quigley says that a lot of the people who were, he says, much of this evidence came from ex-communists, such as Elizabeth Bentley, Louis Badenz, Whitaker Chambers, and John Lautner, and others. All these undoubtedly were ex-communists, and equally undoubtedly revealed much valuable information about communist conspiracies and roused the American public to the danger. But it was also true that it is equally true that the first three names mentioned are known because they dramatized, distorted, and manipulated the evidence for their own purposes.
Mm-hmm.
So the stories get hyped up, and he says this on that page and the three pages prior to that, 920, 921, 922, 923. And if you think about it, to set up all the surveillance state, which the whole surveillance NSA internet stuff that we have now comes out of this, you need this giant threat. So you need – they want the McCarthy even plays his role to frighten everyone in the same way that nowadays neocons get on and they talk about Al-Qaeda and ISIS, right? Al-Qaeda, ISIS. ISIS is going to get us.
Yeah. Right? So, yeah, and so, yeah, because if you look at even today's surveillance state, which is like whether it's the internet, the digital communications, all these things, the infrastructure for this was established during the Cold War, which developed out of, I guess, DARPA, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, ARPANET, right.
Yeah. And, of course, the National Security Agency, which no one really knew existed, or at least most people weren't aware of until, the late 80s or something.
Right.
And they were conducting mass sweeping surveillance, since the 50s,
right?
With telegrams and telephones, and I think you suggest in your talk that even before the age of digital communications, they had somehow created a way to conduct mass surveillance on telephone lines.
Yes, I believe that's mentioned in John Marx's book that they had the ability to do that a long time ago. I think. James Bamford mentions it in his 1983 Puzzle Palace book that surveillance of telephones has existed almost as long as telephones. Obviously, depending on the type of recording devices, but you could still listen in even if you didn't have a phonograph or whatever and get the information, according to Bamford if I recall. Now, another curious element is that the Rockefeller Project mentioned on page 926 to send a group of American nuclear scientists to work with Russian nuclear scientists.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wouldn't that be a little dangerous to do? I mean, if the nuke story is real, might some of these Russian scientists get our nuke secrets?
Yeah.
But no, according to Quigley, that's just part of it. Part of the way he paints this is, it's like, well, you know, we have this Cold War thing going on, but, you know, a lot of people were enlightened and they understood the modern liberal world, and that for the sake of science and education, we needed to get past these old modes of understanding of, you know, opposition and bad guy, good guy. And that's what he says about the space program, is that it's going to catapult America into a new age of understanding. He says primarily, this is Quigley's argument, through education. So he says the biggest impact of the space program would be in American education. Interesting. But I think the crucial part is the admission, probably the most important, this is probably the most important chapter in the whole book, is this section, the nuclear rivalry, because he says the people who were bitching, the McCarthys, the anti-communists, they didn't understand the China lobby and the Institute for Pacific Relations and the New York Times and the Herald Tribune and all these liberal weeklies, he says, and all of these academics at Harvard and all these places, they were not necessarily committed communists. Many of them were. They really believed the ideology. But he says all you had to do is look at who was behind it, and that's J.P. Morgan Chase, the bankers. That's who was running things at these Ivy League universities. That's where they're getting the money.
Yeah, you mentioned the infiltration of these organizations or patronage of these organizations.
Exactly.
The bankers, yeah.
Rockefellers, the Mellons, the Dukes, the Carnegies. And the key page is 938-9, and that's where he says that they realized that the left, he says, was a much better weapon than controlling the conservatives. A much better weapon for getting their plans through. He also mentions, of course, as I said, Walter Lippmann here in this chapter, the guys out of Cambridge, William Whitney Foundation. I mean, there's just a whole list of all these. Yeah. You can keep going. Progressive.
Walter Lippmann was the one who wrote Manufacturing Consent, I think. Hello? Internet. So where were we, Jay?
Yeah, I was just giving an example character of one of these operatives by the name of William Strait. And it says that Strait was in no sense a liberal or a progressive, but was indeed a typical international banker, and that the New Republic magazine was simply a medium for advancing designs of the international bankers. Most notably, to blunt isolationists and anti-British sentiments. And this even prevalent amongst American progressives, while providing them with a vehicle for expressing their views in art, literature, music. So they had a vent, right? But the whole magazine was controlled by an international banker who was part of the London establishment.
And this would be formalized like with the CIA later on when they created the Congress for Cultural Freedom, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And many other magazines like on the right, there was National Review, you know, mm-hmm. whose founder, of course, was Wilma Buckley, who we mentioned earlier.
Exactly.
Skull and Bones, CIA, who actually worked for Howard Hunt in Mexico.
Yes, so. And that's why the next page he describes the Whitney Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, and he talks about Nelson Rockefeller being in charge of USA propaganda in Latin America for the CIA. Pearl Buck is another one of these characters. All these characters...
Also, the Good Earth author.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what is she image of China is she promoting with her book? Of course, she also wins the Nobel Prize.
Yeah, she is one of the communists who is part of the Most of these, like Perlbuck, Professor Fairbank of Harvard, and Professors LaTourette and Rowe of Yale, were children of relatives who have been concerned with China as, quote, missionaries. That's my quote. Yeah.
Like the missionaries who trained Mao, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is the, then, yeah.
He talks about the IPR Communists. That is the Institute for Pacific Relations. And this is just a Rockefeller front.
Wow. That's, yeah. And, you know, what was it, the Union Theological Seminary who had operations in China? That was Rockefeller's outfit?
Oh, absolutely. That's, yeah. The Union was started by the Rockefellers.
Yeah.
And that's who, they were big promoters of liberalism and communism. Excuse me, ecumenism. Liberalism and ecumenism, yeah. In churches was the Union Seminary. I know somebody who went there. We had a big argument one time over that. That person is, by the way, a minister in the PCUSA, which is a perfect example of that denomination completely corrupted by the Rockefellers that we're talking about. I mean, to the point of, you know, gay priests, gay marriage in the churches.
Yeah, which is, again, which is probably some sort of a deep state intel operation.
Absolutely.
You know, promoting that stuff. And of course, I think I've mentioned in other interviews, I think you mentioned that whole agenda, you know, you can trace it back to the foundations of Rockefellers, and mm-hmm. Whether it's, you know, 1969 Planned Parenthood, and talking about promoting homosexuality, you have the Stonewall riots, and of course the whole media promotion of it all.
Yes.
You know, it's all coordinated, you know, as we see today with all the nonsense, stuff that gets talked about. So
now, one family you don't hear a lot about is the Whitney family. And the Whitney family was deeply involved in controlling airlines, particularly Pan American. Now, I've mentioned before, you know, the role of Howard Hughes and characters like that, but we can't forget these other families. And the Whitney family, according to Quigley, was important in, you know, funding a lot of these foundations and these liberal movements. Vanderbilt, of course, play into it. Everybody probably has some idea now about Anderson Cooper, right, being the heir to the Vanderbilt. Peabody family plays into this. I was actually, when I met Chris Kendall from Hoaxbusters a couple weekends ago down in Memphis, he was in the area. I met him in Memphis, and we actually stopped into the Peabody Hotel. And as I understand, that's the same Peabody's that Quigley mentioned here. That's the luxury hotel in Memphis. But I mentioned the airlines because that's a big part of the control system, and people overlook that. But when Patrick was breaking a lot of good stories in relationship to the MH17 and all that plane nonsense that we were hearing last year and the year before.
Yeah.
I was talking about, you know, you can find a lot of interesting history of the CIA connections to airlines. And there's even a movie, right, with Mel Gibson and Robert Downey Jr. called Air America, which is about the CIA airlines, Air America, which traffic drugs. And that's even in the movie.
Yeah, there's Civil Air Transport, which became Air America, I think, right? And there's
Evergreen Airlines, which was a CIA airline.
Alaska Airline, I think, or isn't like something like with Alaska name to it or something, if I got that right. Mm-hmm. But yeah, transportation, communication. And right. You mentioned the Whitneys, and the Whitneys, that's the Boston Brahmin family that traces its fortune back to the opium trade, correct? And the clipper ships.
I would assume so, but I didn't know that.
Yeah.
A lot of these families, as you've said many times, go back to that. Interesting, too, 946, the unions were all just bought off, Quigley says.
They were controlled, and the was that done in conjunction with organized crime?
Quigley says one of these was a communist front, Trade Union Services Incorporated of New York, which in 1946 published 15 trade union papers for all the CIO unions, and this was a, people thought communist, but it was actually run by the Institute for Pacific Relations.
So there you go, controlled opposition again.
Yeah.
And because at the end of the day, you need someone to pay for your groceries and keep the lights on, right?
So yeah,
it's, and that's very easy to dangle a check in front of someone and tell them to do certain things, and they do
exactly. And that's why Quigley says on page 948 that it was not communists, and he says the radical right were all stupid and they didn't understand it.
Well, they didn't have access to the papers of the CFR.
Oh, I know. They were actually the right ones. Quigley is the scoundrel.
Well, he says, but he's really accusing. They're identifying a threat that it's not identifying who the culprit is, but at least they're perceptive, right? I mean,
But he doesn't. He calls them backwards and redneck and dumb.
Well,
at least they figured part of it out. That's what I said in my talk.
And you provide that quote, which is on page 950, where there does exist and has existed for a generation the international Anglophile network, which operates to some extent in the way the radical right believes. The Communists Act. In fact, this network, which is, we may identify as the Roundtable groups, has no aversion to cooperating with communists. So, you know, I'm sorry if I'm a little slow off the mark, but or any other group, and frequently does. I know of these operations of this network because I have studied it for 20 years and was permitted for 2 years in the early 1960s to examine its papers and secret records. Well, I'm sorry, not everyone had that access.
Page 949 to 956 is basically the summary of the entire book.
Yeah.
And all the usual suspects, Cecil Rhodes, William Stead, Walter Lippmann, Beer, Lamont, all these characters.
And Rhodes.
Astors, yeah.
Rhodes was funded by the Rothschilds.
Yes, that's in the Cecil Rhodes biography I have. Yeah.
Which appeared, the Rothschilds family appeared to have gotten largely control of the British state by the 20th century.
It does seem so.
Yeah. And it's interesting because there's also Churchill, who his father, Winston Churchill's father, had gone into debt with a lot of Jewish creditors.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Winston Churchill who had a very expensive lifestyle, far beyond his means. And it was his turn against Hitler, which can be dated to his financial problems going away.
Mm-hmm.
So some people think it was his switch around 1935, 36 to oppose Hitler. He was bought off.
Yeah.
You know.
It's this power structure the radical right in the U.S. has been attacking for years in the belief that they're attacking communism. This is particularly true when these attacks are directed at Harvard socialism or the left-wing newspapers. These misdirected attacks did much to confuse the American people from 1948 to 55. And he goes on to say because the people running it were all the people that he listed.
And one exposure to this is, which is something that not many people heard about, but it was written about, was the Norman Dodd and the Reese Committee investigations. Catherine Casey exposed with the foundations. Just, I think this involved the Rockefeller and particularly the Carnegie Foundation,
mm-hmm.
and their plan, and what she uncovered, the plan to subject the country to various shocks and traumas, usually through war, to transform the country, to collectivize it, and later on, ultimately, to fuse it with the communist bloc.
That was the plan, exactly. Yeah. Now, the next section is the atomics section, and it's page 960. I just had it here. Yeah, 962, where he says many of the scientists had doubts about the possibility of whether this could be done. And he goes on to talk about the psychological operation aspects of it. It was there are a lot of tales, a lot of science fiction. I think it's John and Chris brought me to my attention. The first proposal of this is actually from H.G. Wells. He has this story about the creation of this atomic bomb that can, you know, basically blow up the planet or whatever.
That's his term, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Atomics, yeah.
So a science fiction writer came up with this idea.
Yeah. Now, one thing I noticed I mentioned in the talk was, for example, maybe it's just because I'm not trained in higher level physics, but how does one measure 100 million degrees exactly?
A thermometer. Well, that's hot. That's got to be like 100 million degrees, man. Okay.
Yeah, because now, but see, my understanding is that unless you made it out of steel beams like the World Trade Center, the thermometer the thermometer might melt. Anyway, I don't know.
Yeah,
don't
know. You have these boastful claims. Because you're not a scientist, mm-hmm. Your questions aren't valid. Well, no, just I'm okay. I'm Farmer Brown. Explain it to me in a way that makes sense, and they can't. And yeah, just like with the films you see, is how does the camera survive the explosion?
Mm-hmm. Now another question too: the explosions on that he mentions on 966, Bravo, the Hell Bomb. Quigley says the only person to witness this and tell us about it is a journalist for the New York Times named William Lawrence. So we just have to go by William Lawrence, and he later wrote a book. There's later a book later written called The Hell Bomb, and this is what we're supposed to go by.
It's rather thin gruel, I guess you could say.
Lawrence's stories were accepted as true by the ordinary, well-informed public, except not by scientists. Lawrence, the only newspaper reporter allowed to see the test at Alamogordo or the nuclear explosion on Japan, wrote the book on the H-bomb called The Hell Bomb in 1950. That's an important quote.
Yeah.
The only journalist allowed to see these events.
Now, why would there be one journalist?
Yeah, and why the most notorious lying entity, the New York Times?
All the news that's fit to print.
Fit to print.
Allowed for you to read. Yeah, allowed. Yeah.
And then there's more mentions of tales. Shortly after the Bravo blast at Bikini Atoll, a small Japanese fishing boat called the Lucky Dragon is the basis for the radioactive fallout of the test of Bikini Atoll. And this comes from, I'm not joking, the story published in Japanese in 1954. Now, who in the world could track that down?
Yeah, the source for that. Yeah.
Anyway, so you get a bunch of mentions of that kind of stuff, and then, you know,
we mentioned this before, these films were developed to look at Mountain and Laurel Canyon, which was top state-of-the-art Hollywood, you know, special effects studio.
Mm-hmm.
You know, run by the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
with access by, you know, top Hollywood heads and so forth. So then he goes on to talk about important characters in the deep state apparatus and how many of them would be university heads, right? So we can never overlook the academic aspect of the connection to the deep state and the intelligence agencies. Thomas Watson of International Business Machines, IBM, Milton Eisenhower, and these are the people, Dean Acheson. The reason this is important is that these are the people who are revolving door. They go into the government roles in the Truman administration.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a big part of what Dulles is behind.
And Dulles, Dean, yeah.
Go ahead. Dean,
well, it's interesting because I had a talk with James Perloff regarding the Korean and Vietnam Wars and how we got into those things. And you mentioned sort of this this suspicion that the government's being infiltrated by communists. Mm-hmm. And these cold warriors like Dean Acheson. Mm-hmm. Well, one is the Dean Acheson, Secretary of State for Truman, right?
Yes, right here. Page 981. Yeah,
he was as a young attorney, he represented the Soviet interest in America. He was hired by the Soviet Union. I guess they picked his name out of a phone book, or I guess.
Wow.
And while he was the attorney for the Soviet interest in America in the 30s, and he was, of course, he was Truman's Secretary of State.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these other guys like Lachlan Curry, John Stewart Service, all these people had ties to the Communist Party, and Acheson's law partner was Donald Hiss, Alger Hiss's brother. William Bundy, the father-in-law of, I guess, McGeorge Bundy, was also tied into this clique. But all these people that got us, the people like Walter Rostow, his father was a communist.
Uh-huh.
All these cold warriors in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations all had ties back to communists. So that kind of goes to your thesis, I think.
Speaks okay,
to
your yeah, thesis. I didn't know any of that.
Yeah. And
then we have John Foster Dulles previously being a literal agent of J.P. Morgan.
Yeah, well, it gets in the high finance and communists and all that, yeah.
Exactly.
Wall Street. Yeah, President Kennedy, this is James Perloff's article, President Kennedy authorized the first combat troops, about 10,000 in 1961, on the advice of State Department's Walt Rostow, who had returned from a fact-finding mission to Vietnam. Though the media branded Rostow a hawk, his father had been a Marxist revolutionary in Russia. Two of his aunts belonged to the U.S. Communist Party. His brother, Eugene Debs Rothstein was named after the Socialist Party leader Eugene Debs, and the Eisenhower State Department rejected Walt for employment three times as a security risk. The Kennedy administration only got him in by firing Otto Otepka, the State Department head of security. That was a big scandal because he blocked him, then he was fired. So someone with enough juice had the head of security of the State Department fired for not bringing in this communist into the State Department who got us into Vietnam. So a communist got us into Vietnam. How do you make sense of that in the Cold War dialectic?
Hey, here's another weird connection that Dave McGowan pointed out that I was kind of surprised at. Actress Laura Dern, many David Lynch films.
Yeah.
Her granddad was the Secretary of War at Skull and Bones, I believe, too. Secretary of War under FDR.
So that's right, because Bruce Dern's godmother was Eleanor Roosevelt, wasn't it?
Yes. There you go. That's how that ties in, exactly.
So, I mean, you get these connections. You know, the whole thing with Korea, of course, that's like one world government, New World Order stuff. Like when Dean Acheson gives a speech in 1950, he says that Korea is outside our defense perimeter.
Mm.
So invade. Yeah, also, you know.
I'm sorry. You're right. George Dern is the grandfather of Bruce Dern, great-grandfather of Laura Dern.
Okay. Okay, so you missed a generation. But, yeah, I mean, that's the same thing. That gets into – remember, that's a whole other issue. John Adams is a whole thing about these celebrities, whether it's you're a singer or you're a celebrity, how all these elite connections.
Yeah, they like found Katie some Perry really – John found some interesting ones with Katy Perry's oil family.
Yeah.
And then Miley Cyrus has has a Federal Reserve banker.
I thought Billy Ray Cyrus was just like a failed baseball player turned singer. But but yeah, I mean, it gets into they have all these connections. So, you know, America isn't this self-made, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, meritricious, you know, or
meritocracy.
Meritocracy, right. Society. It's a, I mean, yeah, there are all these people are, you know, they all come from these families that have connections.
John, or Chris dug up an article that he posted from a historian at Harvard, I think, talking about how many of the signers of the Declaration of Independence were actually royalists.
That's right. There's a book. I saw that. People they wanted the president to be as king.
Yeah, we've heard that. But this guy's revolutionary argument was that many of the signers of the Declaration is not against royalty, period, but against Parliament. Now that's I don't know enough about that historian perspective, but it's interesting.
Well, we know there were like people like Alexander Hamilton,
who Hamilton had wanted royalist. King, right?
Yeah. You know. So
and now, go ahead. Well, another element that Quigley doesn't mention what was really going on, which I thought your interview with Chris Milligan was very telling, was Korean War. Because Quigley does talk briefly about Korean War. But of course, it's about commies and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. No mention of drugs. It's just a big part of the Korean War.
Oh, sorry. Do you mean Vietnam War?
Oh, I'm sorry. Vietnam War.
There was, I think, Ed Lansdale went there and kind of kicked the French out.
Yeah, you mentioned that. That's right.
Bien Den Phu, and that's all about controlling the drug networks in Vietnam. And that whole thing, because that's out of Vietnam, that's how you get the pipeline from heroin from Southeast Asia into the United States.
Exactly. Is that the Golden Triangle? Golden Crescent?
The Golden Triangle, I think.
Golden Triangle.
Golden Crescent's in Afghanistan.
That's that area. Turkey,
That area, yeah. But, of course, that's because the part of the operation, the way we worked with the Hmong people, the tribes,
right,
was we, we paid them with opium or heroin or poppy, whatever. And then there's a refining plant there. There was an old Pepsi fat bottling plant that was used, for that.
Yeah,
which is funny because then, of course, when Kennedy's assassinated, Nixon is there's a big convention, a bottling company convention, in Dallas, Texas.
Oh, wow.
And of course, one of the bigger policy reversals out of his assassination was the escalation of the Vietnam War, which opens up the pipeline for drugs. So I don't know if that's just a coincidence. But yeah, like any of these businesses, whether it's fruit or bottling companies, back then they used sugar. And that involves controlling, you know, whether it's, you know, fields in South America, well, or, you know, things like that.
Oh, here's another. By the way, I did finally get Douglas Valentine's Phoenix Project book. I haven't read it yet, but it did come in the mail the other day, but which you recommended. Here's a funny statement that is to the point that you were making a minute ago. Attorney General Herbert Brownwell Jr. confided to a businessman luncheon in Chicago that President Truman knew that Harry Dexter White was a Russian spy, but promoted him from Assistant Secretary of Treasury to the IMF. That doesn't make much sense.
Well, because what they're, you know, what that Bretton Woods system is just one more phase of world mm-hmm. currency. And I think it was John Maynard Keynes who, I guess, wanted the Bancor was the world currency at the time, but they realized there'd be too much opposition politically for it, and it had to be gradually introduced. And we might be getting something like the Bancor with SDRs or something, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, but there was just one phase because the Bretton Woods system, which Harry Dexter White apparently was involved in setting up. So we had a communist spy setting up the post-war economic system.
Exactly.
Yeah. Which set the stage for American dominance because it enthroned the dollar as the world reserve currency, which enabled the deep state to do a whole lot around the world.
And then Dulles goes and basically gets NATO, CETO, CENTRO, CTO going.
Yep.
So here's all your foreign policy, global government right here, already existing.
Yeah, and of course, with the Marshall Plan, there's a huge slush fund for CIA operations in Europe.
Exactly. Yeah, and by the way, that's interesting too, because Quigley will mention a few of those, which I guess, again, because this is 1966, he was limited in what he could talk about or maybe what he knew about. Yeah, but he'll mention the 1953 Iran coup. And he'll mention Guatemala. But if you read Cervando's book, there's dozens of those, obviously.
All over the place, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Whole lists of them. And well, this is the great, this is a great, great paragraph here where he says that after getting rid of Mossadegh, the British, the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, the World Petroleum Cartel, the American government, and the older Iranian elite led by the Shah combined to crush Mossadegh. Under the personal direction of the CIA, Alan Dulles, brother of John Foster Dulles, Alan was a former director of Schroeder Bank in New York, an old associate of Frank Tjark's and a partner in Schroeder Bank in London, director of the Bank of England, as well as Lazard Brothers and the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. It will be recalled that Schroeder Bank helped arrange Hitler's ascension to power in 1933.
Yes, and of course, Dulles is also a big part of the paperclip operation.
And that's why, that's what I was going to say. That's why we can connect Dulles to that. And that's
he's there in Switzerland, like negotiating with SS Wolf, Commander Wolf or something, and of course, arranging all the gold, like the Black Eagle Trust and all the loot.
This is David Talbot's book, Devil's Chessboard. Deals with some of that.
And he's there, yeah.
Just recently came out.
And one thing you mentioned in the book, I think, that Quigley writes about the Operation Ajax in Iran, mm-hmm. the toppling of the Mossadegh government, is that it was the absence of Russian influence in Iran which gave the CIA a free hand. Mm-hmm. And which goes to the idea that we got this idea of the CIA fighting communists, but here is a situation where the government might have been stabilized had there been a stronger Soviet presence to check the CIA mm-hmm. in Iran. but that's an interesting part about the Hutto operation is that the CIA went in and hired mobs mm-hmm. to create riots, fake riots, and destabilize the government.
There we go.
Bless you.
Finally sneezed. Yeah, this is not just Middle East, but I wanted to mention too, he mentions the control of Eurasia. So he hints at the Mackinder Doctrine, page 1002. And that he says the two problems of this period were the situation the U.S. and Russia and whether a new substantial power might grow up on the landmass of Eurasia. So this sounds exactly what
Exactly. Now, you also talk about the oil cartels, the so-called Seven Sisters. Mm-hmm. Now, this is the face of the real New World Order or Illuminati. This is the real Illuminati.
I think they're very high up at the top of it because he mentions the – I forget what page that's on, but he says that this cartel controlled 90% or some outrageous percentage like that. I'll have to find where that is in my notes. I think it's somewhere around here, but – yeah, it's an outrageous amount.
Of the world's oil reserves?
Of the entire world's oil, yeah.
So, but it's funny, the term Seven Sisters was...
Here it is. Yeah.
Go ahead.
92% of the reserves of the world's oil, 88% of production, 77% of refining, and 70% of tonnage in ocean tankers. And this is in 1949. By 1949, the cartel of Anglo-Iranian, Royal Dutch Shell, Esso, Calso, Saucony Vacuum, Gulf, and Texaco.
And they're all working together. There's no competition. It's a cartel.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Hence, it's a cartel, exactly.
That's the problem there. But the term Seven Sisters it was coined by this guy, Enrico Mattei. He was the head of the Italian State Oil Company, who I guess ran afoul of the Seven Sisters when he started negotiating these independent deals and giving the countries a better deal, giving a larger percentage of profits. And what happens to him?
He probably ended up dead, but I remember reading about Seven Sisters on Wikipedia. Yeah,
his plane blew up.
Yeah. Okay. There you go.
So another convenient plane crash or whatever, you know, which goes back to airlines. But I think he was on a private plane that went down. Smaller.
Yeah. Would you agree with that? That the oil, we could place some of these oil groups at the top of the pyramid.
Yeah, because it's energy, and I think now. I think if you want to, they've probably moved into big agri and big pharma because that's being merged, like with Monsanto and some of these big agriculture companies that are combining with science with genetically modified organisms, and it's control of the world and controlling food. Introduce these Terminator seeds, which is absolutely insane. And you know, as you control the energy, you can throttle the global economy. You can the world's currency is the dollar, at least, is based on the petrodollar. And this is also the same reason why you manage drug networks, right? Because so much of the global finance is based on drug proceeds. And so you have to manage it, to control it, and under the same way that you create a global crisis with nuclear with world wars or nuclear terror, you create a pretext to manage the world, right? Well, same thing with the drugs. The drug war, you have to manage the drug war. You have to pick the cartels and pick the banks that are going to funnel this drug money, and those proceeds are going to distort or control or direct the economy in certain ways. That's, Catherine Austin Fitz gets into that with a lot of her research, what she uncovered. And she was listening to an interviewer recently with a dark journalist, and she said she didn't really understand how the New World Order functioned until she moved to Tennessee to a rural area and observed how people managed livestock. Well, that's comforting.
Well, yeah, I could see that because, I'm in Tennessee too, and there's cows everywhere, and there's other domesticated farm animals.
Yeah.
And that's animal farm. There you go.
Yeah. So it's like, so that's how they see us,
Now the, I don't want to give away too much of what I saved for the subscribers.
Oh, no.
Beyond what we mentioned so far, because there's a lot of Stalin stuff and NKVD stuff. And then it kind of gets into topics that I'm going to talk about in the next final talk on Strategy and Hope. But there is a lot of interesting stuff come out, with WikiLeaks, if you want to talk about that a little bit.
Oh, yeah, the election and this FBI reopening the investigation. It's based on these, information or emails that were on the laptop of Anthony Weiner, a.k.a. Call Us Danger. Charlie Danger, and his estranged wife, who is a, I think, have been an aide for Hillary Clinton for the better part of 20 years, I think. Mm-hmm. And let you talk about you. I think.
Well, I just basically, it looks like, I'd made my video right before it started coming out about more of the revelations of the sex stuff. So I didn't include the sex aspect's not in it. I just talked about the top 10 or so scandals that I saw as vindicated, which kind of vindicates everything that so-called conspiracy theorists have talked about for so long. So you have,
let's go through those.
Well, you have the Gulf states funding ISIS and jihad, or the mercenaries, basically, mm-hmm. which is what we've talked about for so long. And this shows Hillary is in full knowledge of what's going on. For those that didn't believe that she did. You've got Turkey, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, Jordan. And so Benghazi, was, this is what the CFR called for in 2012. And they have their article publicly posted of using, quote, Al-Qaeda in Syria. The article from the CFR says, it's in my video, the jihadis they're pretty awesome. I'm not joking. That's what this guy says. He says they would provide zeal and morale for the takedown of Assad. And so this, and again, now what was Hillary doing at this time? Well, she was running the Benghazi situation, which is, again, this is funneling mechanism of weapons and aid to the, quote, jihad. The next one is, I just kind of listed them, right? They're not any like top 10. They're just a list of them. I thought it was funny that CNN said that it's illegal to read these. But then they turned around and said, we will read them for you. Well, now, wait a minute. If it's illegal, how is CNN going to read them and vet them for us?
Yeah, it's, yeah, I know. What law are they citing, by the way?
No, really? Yeah. The Democrats paid agitprop violence, paid for that. We knew that. That's nothing new. But what was interesting is that connection.
Was this the Donald Ducks?
Well, I just meant the paid for a violent eruption at Trump rallies and busing people around for voter fraud.
Yeah, because there was a thing called the Donald Ducks where they show up, and it turns out that it was funded by the Clinton. It was supposed to be independent. Mm-hmm. It was funded. Was it Bob Creamer, I think was his name, the guy who resigned? And there's a conversation where he's talking about the duck costumes. Is, you know how hard it is to get a duck costume for an adult?
Hey, yeah,
really, it's very funny. He's like, it's like usually they're for kids. It's hard to get one for adults. But go ahead. I'm sorry. Yeah, that's funny.
It's just that same sort of what we think of might be a Saul Alinsky style stuff.
Yeah.
Betrays once again the banker in the background with Soros busing people around and the admission of the Democratic vote fraud of, oh, we just bust the minorities around to different locales. Again, Soros comes up in the background of this. And the crisis actors, so the provocateurs that were bussed around Ferguson, right? If you recall that, this last couple summers, the racial incitement. The shadow government, this is not WikiLeaks, this is the FBI reference in the CNBC article that explicitly says shadow government, and the officials who were told about the shadow government having to okay these things, they were unaware of what this was, the seventh floor. They're like, what? What is that? You mean there's a group above us that says what can and can't be done? And that was in reference to FOIA requests, by the way. The FOIA requests are filtered by the seventh floor shadow government, is what it says. Did you see that?
Yes. That would be the seventh floor of Langley.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Let's see. Comey was, of course, on the HSBC board at one point. And there would be, there are obviously conflicts of interest with regard to the Clinton Foundation, which HSBC donated millions of dollars to the Clinton Foundation. Podesta coordinating with Hollywood, obviously. I don't know, that shouldn't really be a surprise. Hillary has on her call list the top Hollywood directors, Katzenberg, Warner Brothers people. The emails say, quote, from Huma, make Soros happy. That was a good one. One of the Podesta, I believe it was a Podesta email, said that we've got to make the American people more complacent, more docile, like you mentioned, farm animals.
More complacent, more docile, because that's what, mm-hmm. that's what a engaged citizenry should be. That's great. Yep.
Coordination with Google and Schmidt. Schmidt basically drawing up the plans for the campaign or the online aspects of it or something to that effect. And then, of course, the massive coordination with mainstream media and some 65-plus mainstream media pundits and journalists all coordinating with the Hillary campaign. Now, Hillary has destroyed nations, as we've said. Trump has built buildings and said a few cuss words that we know of. Now, so that alone, I think, is amazing. You know, that we have this populace, that this liberal establishment that pretends to be up in arms and in a tizzy and having convulsions over Trump saying the P word, when it's that same liberal establishment that promotes pedophilia and, you know, the most degenerate stuff on television. Right. Total just absolutely makes no sense.
Hollywood outrage that Trump would be, you know, as a womanizer. So
the outrage, I guess, is that he is heterosexual.
Yes. Yes. He's not deviant enough, maybe.
Right. Right. So the, and then, of course, what's interesting is that we get this character, Evan McMullen, that suddenly shows up connected to Mitt Romney and Goldman Sachs, obviously some Mormon CIA angle front phony.
Yeah, he's running out in Utah or something. Mm-hmm. He's polling. They could pull that away from Trump. And yeah, you know, so, yeah, he's this connection. Yeah, you mentioned Goldman Sachs, and it's part of the Mormon mafia, I guess. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then to crown it all off, who does Hillary say is behind it all? Russia. And that Trump is run by Russia.
Yeah, apparently his computer has a link right up to Putin's computer or something. They strategize or something.
And there's no election fraud. There's no voter fraud, according to Obama. But Obama and the establishment want to bring the UN to police the election in case of voter. But I thought there was no voter fraud.
Yeah.
So just total nonsense, total. Well, it's, in other words, all of this WikiLeaks stuff, which in itself may not be that big of a deal. Well, actually, it is kind of like the biggest. It's 10 times worse than Watergate, right?
What you're saying, yeah, because Watergate, I'm not aware of any dead bodies. you could make the case that E. Howard Hunt's wife, maybe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was one thing with her mysterious plane crash.
The Clinton. They should be in jail.
Yeah, well, but they're guilty. But the thing is, to really to expose the Clintons is to, again, expose open a can of worms. I mean, then you mean, you mean Arkansas, the Bushes, and, you know, these things. And even some of the things with Epstein. Epstein, you know, what that opens up.
Well, that's what's come out in the past couple of days is the reflection going back to the pedophilia stories of Little St. James Island and that this is kind of a blackmail operation to entrap the wealthy and the powerful.
And there's some evidence there's some also evidence that it implicates Trump, which because she is, you know, that place down he owns where this girl Veronica, or is it Veronica Clark, or was her name, I think. So it's hard to, I mean, if you listen to some of the, I just heard an interview with, what was his name, from the Ron Paul Peace Center on RT, talking about this whole latest thing with Daniel McAdams. And he's talking, and people are now openly talking about the deep state, by the way.
Yeah.
So, Peter Dale Scott, you've been vindicated. But, there's a revolt. One thing is that the reason why this latest thing occurred is there's a revolt among the FBI.
Yes.
And I saw a headline today that the FBI is pro-Trump. That's the accusation now. But they were so disgusted with Comey's decision last July that there's been a ton of resignations or threats to resign. And so he had to do this. One thing is but you know, Comey is a puppet. He's not a string puller. So he's not taking these decisions in a vacuum or by himself. That right. Some people feel that it's some faction within the deep state, the people that choose our candidates for us, have turned against Hillary Clinton for some reason. Maybe it's Russia, because of Russia. Maybe it's because she's too close to the neoconservatives. Mm-hmm. And there's, shall we say, a less insane, a more responsible faction to this criminal syndicate that runs things. That's saying, whoa, wait a second. At first we thought maybe we may have wanted Hillary. Now maybe we don't. She's too corrupt. Too dangerous. Oh. Yeah. If she gets elected, she's going to be facing impeachment hearing, especially if Republicans maintain control of Congress. Mm-hmm. There could be impeachment within months of this person, and maybe it's just better to have Trump in there.
That's what some people think, yeah.
Yeah.
And I just uploaded my video last night where I kind of give my thesis on all that. So if people can check out my video, I titled it Clinton WikiLeaks Exposes Entire Shadow Government, where we go through these points and the different articles that treat of it. But yeah, I guess we're gonna see a lot in the next couple of days for sure.
Yeah, we'll see what happens Wednesday morning, what the results are. Mm-hmm. And there's always the chance of voter fraud, electronic voting. You don't know anymore. It's a question of who controls the software now.
Right.
You know, and the software's proprietary, by the way, meaning that. You know, wait a second. So there's no public right now, from what I understand, the way the law reads is the public has no right to analyze the data which produces the votes.
Yeah, and this has been talked about by Bev Harris for a long time.
Yeah, and what happened in Ohio in 2004,
yes.
These votes were switched and it gave the election to Bush.
Yeah.
And it can be done electronically now. Now, who's to say? I mean, that's one dimension to it. Again, it'd be interesting to see what happens. For a while, I thought Trump was put up there to ensure Hillary's election. I'm not quite so sure anymore. I thought now, because he apparently has momentum and he does draw bigger crowds. But again, if you're controlling the voting machines and they're electronic, I don't know how relevant that is anymore.
Well, I was on a radio thing and that came up. How do you think? Well, I mean, they technically could get away with it because there's nothing that, I mean, what would you do? Like I guess it would have to be Trump contesting it is the only way that could potentially even happen if they did noticeably steal it.
Yeah. So, and again, it is the Electoral College which elects.
Right.
You know, and we do, Americans do not have a right to vote to President of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
We elect electors,
mm-hmm.
and those electors aren't bound, by the way. And what we don't know, so we also don't realize, is that the states themselves could change the law. They won't. But we learned this in 2000 when Florida had its electoral college compromise. I mean, there's a chance that it wouldn't be represented in the December 19th vote when they go to Washington and actually elect the president.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the dispute between Gore and Bush, there was a chance that they wouldn't meet the deadline. They had to be certified by a certain date to go to Washington, D.C.
Okay.
And so the state legislature was going to step in and appoint the electors, because the Constitution gives the states total authority to decide the manner in which the electors are chosen. All the states have chosen a general election to elect electors since the 19th century. Mm-hmm. But it used to be that they'd be appointed by the state legislature in many cases. I think that's why Jackson is considered the first Democratic elected president, because his election, most states had their electors elected at large.
Mm-hmm.
But so the point is that because of the dispute in 2000, the legislature in Florida, which was Republican controlled, was about to appoint the electors. And they have plenary authority, I think is the term used in the Constitution, to choose the manner in which the electors are chosen. So no Supreme Court, no one can question it. It's the electors which is popularly elected, the state legislature, and they were going to do that. Say, listen, we're getting tired of all this back and forth, all this litigation and media. We're just going to appoint the electors. But that's when the Supreme Court stepped in, stopped the voting recounts, which were started by the state Florida Supreme Court. Which is stepping into it and involving itself, which is very liberal, by the way. Florida had this weird situation where the Florida Supreme Court was really liberal and the legislature was really conservative. So you had that going with you're the Florida Supreme Court stepping in and ordering recounts all over the place. So what the point is, then the Supreme Court steps in with this ruling that says that it's a violation of equal protection or something, which is ridiculous. And they give the Bush the election over to Bush. The odd thing about that election was that if you just let the state legislature do it, they would have given the election to Bush anyway. For some reason, the court had to step in and do this and confuse the matter. Maybe they just like doing that with this weird decision that they came up with, you know, with Bush v. Gore, where they hobbled together this weird decision where it's a violation of equal protection or something, because the recounts, there was no standard for recounts, you know, with the voting. Remember the hanging chads and all that stuff? And there was, you know, whether what was a valid ballot or not. And then, of course, that was a great propaganda against paper ballots, wasn't it? So
yeah, that's a good point.
Was that a psyop to bring in electronic?
To bring in electronic, right?
Yeah, it's so efficient and clean. Yeah, right.
Like the transition to electronic currency will be.
Yes, it's convenient, clean, and you know, great. And you just can't look into the inside the box. You have to accept your results.
But it's interestingly being sold as a security means. Which is ridiculous.
Yeah, which is
you have much greater security with electronic currency. Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's like security in your home, right? ADT monitoring. Let us watch your home for you.
Yeah.
It's like, so.
Yeah, let a bunch of creepy guys sitting at a computer somewhere just watch your home all day for you.
Yeah, what was that? There was an NFL player who was charged with killing, was it the girlfriend's? Not his girlfriend. It was some guy who had something to do with his girlfriend or fiance. I'm not sure what they did, but he basically was charged with murder, and they used his home security system against him.
Wow.
So there you go. I mean, you're better off with a gun and a good lock, you know. So.
All right. Well, I think I'm gonna have to
go
for the evening, but this has been good, and then I'll have the next final installment of Tragedy and Hope up soon.
Excellent. Well, listen, thanks a lot, Jay. That's Jay's Analysis, of course, jaysanalysis.com, where you can listen to his lectures, his reports, his analysis. His articles are great. And you can also support his work by subscribing for $4.95 a month, $60 a year, or, right? Is that correct?
Yep.
And your book is coming out in a few weeks, Esoteric Hollywood?
Yeah, very, very, very soon, in the next week or two. Yeah.
Okay, listen, I'll let you go. And thanks a lot. And I'll have this up soon. When I do, I'll send you the link.
All right. Thanks, Tim.
Great. Good night. Take it easy.
Night.
Bye-bye.